1, 2, 3, 4.
From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. The Melvins were an inspiration to the 90s alternative rock explosion, but their own mighty sound is hard to classify. The Melvins join us to talk about their 34-year career.
Plus, singer-songwriter Billy Bragg makes the case for a little-known 1950s music craze.
It's the moment when British pop music moves from being a kind of jazz-based confection for grown-ups to becoming a guitar-led music for teenagers that will eventually conquer the world.
The story of Skiffle, coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and Greg, we have got the mighty Melvins talking to us about their career on this episode of Sound Opinions. They defy any easy genre classification. I mean, the best way I can describe the Melvins is one of those handful of bands, every time I see them, the top of my head gets sliced off and my brains spill out all over me. That's the Melvins, coming up later in the show.
But first, the story of Skiffle.
Rock on a line, mighty good road. Rock on a line, road to ride.
Oh, the rock on a line,
she's a mighty good road. If you want to ride it, gotta ride it like you're flying. Get your ticket at the station on the rock on a line.
That is singer-songwriter Billy Bragg performing Rock Island Line. That song was a huge hit in 1956 for a British singer named Lonnie Donegan, and it spawned a craze across the UK for skiffle music, a raw take on American blues played by white British youth.
You know, skiffle was fairly short-lived, Greg, and it never made a big impact in America. It's largely forgotten today, even in the UK. But Billy Bragg argues that skiffle was a revolutionary moment in British pop music that put guitars in the hands of teenagers. Always a good thing. It laid the foundation, he says, for the British invasion of the 60s and even introduced the DIY sensibility of punk.
Bragg's written about the skiffle craze in a new book called Roots, Radicals, and Rockers. And he sat down recently with Sound Opinions producer Evan Chung, and he made the case for skiffle's importance, starting off by defining exactly what skiffle is.
A simple definition would be British schoolboys in the mid-1950s playing Lead Belly's repertoire. That would be the 140-character definition of skiffle.
Well, jumping me, told his little woman, gonna cook my supper soon. I got 90 miles of track, I'm going to line. Gonna line them by the light of the moon. Lord, Lord, gonna line them by the light of the moon.
Lonnie Donegan, who is kind of the progenitor of the skiffle craze, he has a hit in 1956 with Lead Belly's Rock Island Line. And he goes out on tour. He does a week in Liverpool in November 1956. George Harrison goes every night. He's 13. Paul McCartney goes one night. He's 14. And he gets his dad to get rid of his trumpet and buy him a guitar as a result. Within 2 weeks of Donegan playing in Liverpool, John Lennon has formed his own skiffle band called Quarrymen with his mates at school. If you imagine that experience, obviously we know about that, that microcosm, because of what came after. But if you imagine that times a million, maybe, it's very much a kind of a craze, a playground craze. Sales of guitars in the UK after Donegan had his hit with Rock Island Line went from 5,000 a year to 250,000 a year in 1957. It's a bit like the Cabbage Patch Dolls, you know. Every kid had to have a guitar, every boy anyway, because it's very much a boy thing. So the real effect is it kind of invigorates a group of people who you could really sort of call the first British teenagers.
Got a 38 pistol as long as my arm. Kill anybody that done me harm. I'm gonna ride Railroad Bill. I'm gonna ride Railroad Bill.
If you want to understand what came later, if you want to understand the Beatles or Astral Weeks or Led Zepp 3 or Motley Hoople's All the Young Dudes, if you want to really find out where that impulse originally came from, then you can't get to the roots of British pop and rock and folk and R&B without that significant moment.
Well, let's back up a bit and let's try to trace the history of skiffle for a moment. So it starts in this maybe even more surprising genre, which is the trad jazz scene in the UK. So what was trad jazz?
Trad jazz was an attempt by fans of jazz to get back to an authentic sense of what jazz was, as was played, they believed, as was played in New Orleans, probably from sort of like 1895 in its very earliest iteration to about 1915. It was kind of very difficult for the trad musicians in the UK to do anything other than get inspiration from the records. And on the records were predominantly recorded in the 1920s. They're very early recordings. And because of the primitive equipment they recorded on, the musicians had to blow very hard to be heard. You know, they just put a mic up in the middle of the room and you just went for it. So the trad guys in the UK, they just blew, like Billy-O, they blew as hard as they could, like these records. And as a result, after about 30 minutes, their lips were so numb, they didn't have much technique. They couldn't play. So in order not to lose their audiences, what they did was they put down their brass instruments, and they picked up acoustic guitars and washboards for rhythm and a double bass, and they played what would broadly be Lead Belly's repertoire.
Yonder come a Miss Rosie, how in the world do you know? I can tell her by apron and the dress she wore, umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. She's going to ask the governor, turn her loose, my man, let the midnight special.
They called these sessions breakdown sessions. They became very popular, sometimes more popular than the actual trad jazz they were playing.
And it's out of these breakdown sessions that the music that we call skiffle emerges from. So where does that term skiffle, where does that get introduced?
Interestingly, skiffle as a word originates in Chicago. On the south side of Chicago in the 20s and 30s, African-Americans would have rent parties, both a cultural event and a way to raise some money, where they would cook up some down-home food, brew up some hooch, and they'd get some guy to come along and play barrel house piano. It was a pretty raucous event, but this event was called a skiffle. Mm-hmm. But when the trad jazz guys in England, particularly a guy named Ken Collier, he did a session for the BBC, but when they decided to do some of these breakdown songs, the producer very observantly said, well, what band is this? This isn't the Ken Collier jazz band. What are you playing? And the band's manager, he said, oh, this is our skiffle band. This is the Ken Collier skiffle band. But in that moment, he changed the meaning of the word from a rent party on the south side of Chicago to a subgenre of American roots music that was indigenous to the British Isles.
Down by the riverside, gonna lay my burden down. Ain't gonna study war no more.
Skiffle's kind of the rare genre where there's one song that you can point to as kind of the definitive moment.
Yep.
And that's Lonnie Donegan's recording of Rock Island Line. Where did that song come from?
Well, the song originally came from, in its absolute essence, it came from the Rock Island Line engineering yards in Little Rock, Arkansas. But it's first recorded by the Library of Congress in 1934 at Cummings State Prison Farm, where John Lomax, assisted by Lead Belly, is recording prison work songs. And an octet of inmates led by a guy named Kelly Pace, they come and sing it as a call and response song.
I see the Rock Island Line.
Here's a mighty good road.
I see the Rock Island Line.
Here's a road to ride.
I see the Rock Island Line.
Here's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
Lead Belly had to hear a song twice, and he got it. So he took it away, and he turned it into the version that we're more familiar with, where he added the story about the train at the start of it and brought the verses in from the blues and from nursery rhymes.
For the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. For the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. For the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine to get your ticket and standing on the Rock Island Line.
And it's this version that Lonnie Donegan bases his version on. In July 1954, Donegan records Rock Island Line as part of a New Orleans jazz album that they don't have enough material to make. So they stick a couple of these skiffle songs on just to pad out the record, really. You know, Lonnie Donegan records Rock Island Line with acoustic guitar, washboard, and bass, no drums. He just goes hell for leather at Rock Island Line, and it's unlike anything kids in the UK have ever heard. It gets into the charts in the first charts of 1956 and just takes off like a rocket.
Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. The Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like a fight to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Hallelujah, I'm safe from sin. The good Lord's coming for to see me again. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road.
In my country, that is really revolutionary. Donegan is the first British artist to get in the charts playing a guitar.
What was the appeal of Lonnie Donegan to the audience in the UK?
I'm not sure it was so much Donegan as what he was doing. If I could just sort of set the scene a little bit for you, for those kids who were buying his records. Rationing in my country ended a month before Lonnie Donegan recorded Rock Island Line. So it lasted from 1940 until 1954. So a kid like, let's say, John Lennon, born in 1940, it's not until he's 14 years old he can go in a sweet shop and buy what he wants. So if you can imagine all that pent-up sort of urge to be able to have what you want, being told all the time you can't have this, you have to have a bit of paper to get when you buy something, you have to have a ration book. And because what happens is Donegan's record gets in the charts about 3 or 4 months after Rock Around the Clock gets into the chart.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock.
But what happened with Rock Around the Clock? Although it got to number one in the charts, the BBC barely played it. The BBC was the mediator of all British culture at the time. Radio was king. And my sense is these kids thought, you're what? You're going to ration rock and roll? You're going to ration rock and roll now? It's finally coming. You're going to ration it. I'll tell you what, mate. I'm going to buy a guitar and I'm going to play this music whether you like it or not.
Dig those crazy sailors.
And I think that was the impulse that led Van Morrison, who's 12 years old, to go out and start playing Leadbelly songs.
Did the teenagers listening to Skiffle and to rock and roll, did they see them as related movements at the time?
I feel they must have done, really, because the mainstream culture was so bland. You know, the British singers were crooners.
Someone broke into my heart and stole a beat or two. The finger of suspicion points at you.
And here's Donegan, he's not even got a tie on, he's not even got a jacket. He's just shaking it out, and you can hear it on the record, you know. He's kind of, and then the other thing that they really surprised everybody was that it turned out he wasn't an American. Because when they initially heard it, everyone assumed he was an American. He was playing a guitar. British people didn't play guitars, British artists. And he was just thrashing these three chords. It was so basic, anyone could do it. And when word spread that he was born in Glasgow and he's lived most of his life in London, well, this was probably the most incendiary message ever imparted to British youth. One, you don't have to be a trained musician to play music. And two, you don't have to be an American to sing American songs.
Arm and arms to ball, and you might win, win, win. Bet on stew ball, and you might win. Once bet on stew ball, and you might win.
This is why Skiffle represents why it's so important. It's such a paradigm shift in our culture. It's the moment when British pop music moves from being a kind of jazz-based confection for grown-ups to becoming a guitar-led music for teenagers that will eventually conquer the world.
And teenagers, you've alluded to this a bit before, but I think an important part of the context, this is really the first moment in history where teenagers, as we know it,
certainly in
exist.
Britain, what happens after the war is that working-class youth leave school at 15 and they can quite easily get work. There's a lot of work about. So they've got money and now they want something to spend it on. These kids leaving school, particularly the young women, are instantly visible because sales of cosmetics, of clothing, of records, rockets.
80% of the disc output is bought by the youngsters. That's 50 million records a year in Britain alone. All industry knows that to please the teenagers is the golden way to big dividends.
And this is when Donegan comes along. And the guitar represented a future. It's a paradox that they go back to Leadbelly in order to make the future happen. But it was a way of, you know, by picking up the guitar, they were saying to their parents, your culture is dead. We have our own culture. This is a new thing.
This is us, see? We're today. If you don't dig us, shoot away some square joint to the rest of the creeps. Well, why not stick around and get with it?
We're going to make the future happen. They built a bridge to the future that was so powerful that it crossed the Atlantic, and it took them to the top of the United States charts.
Right. Lonnie Donegan's Rock Island Line comes over and becomes a hit in the U.S. It reaches number 8, and it seems to have, at least for a moment, a big impact on American music.
It becomes the first song that Phil Spector can play on guitar. Art Garfunkel buys it. It really actually strikes a chord with people. Donegan goes on the Ed Sullivan Show, and the other guest that night is Ronald Reagan. He does a few sketches with Ronald Reagan. And interestingly, Johnny Cash's first album for Sun Records opens with Rock Island Line.
Well, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. Well, if you ride, you got to ride it like you find it. It's a ticket, that's a station for the Rock Island Line.
Lonnie Donegan was influencing Johnny Cash. That's a real kind of head spinner, isn't it?
Right. So for Skiffle to be a craze, there must be more artists than just Lonnie Donegan.
There is, yeah, there are. There are more artists than Lonnie Donegan. There's Chas McDavitt and Nancy Whiskey, who had a hit with Freight Train, which I think was a hit here in America as well.
Freight Train, going so fast. Freight Train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on. Won't you tell me where he's gone?
There's Johnny Duncan, who was an American airman who came to England and had a hit with a song called Last Train to San Fernando, which was actually originally a Calypso song.
Last train to San Fernando. Last train to San Fernando. If you miss this one, you'll never get another one. Be-de-de-de-bum-bum to San Fernando.
There were the Vipers, who were never a jazz band. They were just skifflers. They're kind of like the Skiffle Clash. They're kind of rough and ready, and they stayed rough and ready throughout their career.
Now me and my wife went to town.
Silly lady, silly.
Well, we went to buy a $10 gown.
Silly lady, silly.
Oh, don't she rock me, daddy-o.
Oh, don't she rock me, daddy-o.
Don't she rock me, daddy-o.
Well, don't she rock me, daddy-o.
And then there's loads of little bands, but none of them ever got to the stage apart from Donegan. Really to the stage where they had a long-term career. They kind of came and went. Peak Skiffle happens in July 1957 when John Lennon's Skiffle Band are playing a church fete in Liverpool, and Paul McCartney comes along and Lennon and McCartney meet for the first time. Then eventually Paul brings his mate George Harrison along. They become the Quarrymen.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yeah, that'll be the day when you make me cry.
And this is the significant thing about Skiffle. It's not what Donegan and Chas McDavitt and those guys did. It's what their fans did. It's what the 12 and 13 and 14-year-olds did. They estimate there were between 30 and 50,000 Skiffle groups playing at peak Skiffle, but they were playing in scout huts and church halls and school gyms. They never recorded anything. Every sentient schoolboy in the UK learns 3 chords on a guitar.
Streamline, stream, fastest train around. Hard-working tree boys ain't gonna hurt you none. I'm gonna leave in the morning, maybe on that streamline train.
So what that means is that when the Beatles do break in the United States of America in January 1964, there is a whole cohort of road-hardened bands ready to follow them. And in the 2 years between the Beatles' first hit and the end of 1965, there's a British artist at the top of the charts in the US for 52 weeks out of 104, and every single one of them, apart from Petula Clark, originated in a skiffle band.
Right, and you have this whole chapter at the end of your book where you list all the artists that were influenced by skiffle or started in skiffle, and it's virtually every British invasion band you can think of, the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, the Kinks, the Hollies, the Animals, the Zombies.
When it carries on into the 70s, I mean, you know, there's a lovely clip on YouTube of a 14-year-old Jimmy Page from a BBC Kids program singing a song called Mama Don't Allow No Skiffle Playing Around Here.
Well, we don't care what Mama don't allow, gotta play that skiffle any old how. Mama don't allow no skiffle around here.
Now then, you're called what?
J.G. Skiffle Group.
And you come from?
Epsom.
What are your two names? Yours is?
James Page and
David Housman. Both from Epsom.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do when you leave school? Take up skiffle?
No, I want to do biological research.
David Bowie's first gig was singing Lonnie Donegan songs at Scout Camp. Elton John, Rod Stewart, all those guys, Ian Hunter from Motley Hoople, Bjorn from ABBA. his first band was a skiffle band. So it's the influence that skiffle had at a very early age on these kids, and they were kids, that goes on to, although they don't themselves play skiffle, it goes on to, as I claim in the title of my book, change the world.
So there's 50,000 potential DIY skiffle bands. Among those are the people who create the template for rock music on both sides of the Atlantic for the next 20, 30 years. What is the reputation of skiffle in the UK today?
It doesn't really have much of a reputation, unfortunately, because what happens is that in 1967, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band comes out and Rolling Stone is produced, published for the first time. What happens is beards are grown, they're stroked, concepts come into music making, and pop, good old fun pop, becomes rock. And so in that atmosphere, if you're a British rock star and Rolling Stone says to you, who inspired you to pick up the guitar? You're going to say Chuck Berry, aren't you? You're going to say Buddy Holly. You're not going to say Chas McDavitt and Nancy Whiskey. So skiffle becomes like that really embarrassing photo from the school yearbook. You don't know what it's saying. It gets put in the attic.
But I guess maybe the overarching question some might have is the music itself worth listening to? Or put another way, why today should I listen to a Lonnie Donegan record when I have access to the original Lead Belly or the original Big Bill Brunsey records?
Well, that was a good question at the time. And in comparison, I don't even think Donegan would say that his records were better than Lead Belly's versions of the song. It does sound pretty ropey if you just listen to the music. It does sound a bit quirky. And I mean, the fact is none of us will really ever be able to be in that position of a 15-year-old who's grown up in a war and rationing, listening to, you know, white bread English jazz-based pop, to suddenly hear Donegan come out the radio growling, singing Rock Iron Line. But something happened to those guys. Something very similar to what happened with me when I first saw The Clash. That's partly what drew me to this. I think there's a lot of similarities between skiffle and punk. Here's Three Chords Now, former group, DIY music. But more importantly than that, the way the Clash empowered me, because they were like me. And I think that's what happens with Donegan. Donegan breaks the fourth wall of British pop. And he doesn't only talk to kids, but he actually hands them the means by which to escape from the past, which is the acoustic guitar. He says, come on, you can do this. And they pick it up, and we're still living with the world they created.
That is singer-songwriter Billy Bragg talking with Sound Opinions producer Evan Chung about his new book on the 1950s skiffle phenomenon, Roots, Radicals, and Rockers. Do you have any thoughts about skiffle and its place in music history? Call and leave us a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. After a short break, we'll talk with the Melvins about their phenomenal 34-year career. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot, my partner's Jim DeRogatis, and that's a little bit of Christ Hammer from the new double album, A Walk with Love and Death, from our guests, the Melvins.
They're always good at titling, Greg.
Wow. 34 years ago, they began in Washington State, Jim, 1984 to be precise. The core members since that time have been one Buzz Osborne, otherwise known as King Buzzo.
Oh, yeah.
The guy with the weird haircuts, and he's on guitar and vocals, and Dale Crover on drums. I swear, there's been a few times where I've seen Dale Crover play drums, and I thought, those things look like the size of baseball bats. How does he swing them so hard?
Yeah, there are a few drummers in rock history, I think, who've been that powerful.
Now, they've got a revolving bassist routine in the band, much like Spinal Tap with the revolving drummers. Melvin's has got the revolving bassist.
Yeah.
They've had a bunch of good ones, and the current one is a terrific one. Steve McDonald from the Great Red Cross, and Off, a previous guest on Sound Opinions.
Red Cross, one of the great psychedelic pop bands of all time.
Yes, yeah, so McDonald's is a lifer much in the same way that Osborne and Crover are. Now, this band, you know, you'd mentioned at the top how unclassifiable their sound is. I mean, metal fans worship them, but they're kind of on the fringe of metal.
Yeah.
They're a little bit avant-garde. There's a sense of humor operating in the music. There's a heaviness. The one thing that everyone agrees on is that almost everyone who was anyone in that Seattle scene of the late 80s, early 90s paid attention to the Melvins. They were just a unique band, and they really created a foundation for what became known as that Seattle scene. You know, bands like Nirvana, Soundgarden, members of Pearl Jam, they all went to those shows. They all saw this band. They all loved this band. So extremely influential in the sound of the Pacific Northwest. And by extension, the whole heavy avant-garde music scene in the United States and around the world in many ways. This band has longevity for a reason. Music connoisseurs love them.
We are going to talk 34 years of musical anarchy with the Melvins. Welcome to Sound Opinions, Buzz Osborne, Dale Crover, and Stephen McDonald.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So 34 years, and this is album, as I count it, 25. And it's actually a double album, A Walk with Love and Death.
So that's 25, 26.
20, oh, okay. Is that how we're going to count it?
Sure, why not?
Okay,
why not?
All right. Yeah,
really?
Why not? So the 26th album.
No reason not.
Maybe more.
I mean, you know, it sounds weird to say of any Melvins record that this is ambitious, because they all are. The Melvins do nothing small. But this one being broken up sort of conceptually, the love half is different from the dead half. Musically, we have differences. And the one is a soundtrack. Is that right, Buzz? And you love film.
Yes, it's a soundtrack. One thing I've always hated about soundtrack records is that I've gotten so used to the movies listening to the music with other things going on that I miss the incidental stuff that's happening along with the music. So I wanted to make sure it added stuff like that, and then that ended up being the entire soundtrack for the movie as well. So,
okay.
Baby heart. It's a baby. Baby heart.
You know, I wanted it to be a lot of ambient type stuff, and I don't really think it's that weird, but some people do. I think it was. I think I saw it described as baloney. The second album is baloney.
Well, what do you want, though? You're getting two for one.
I don't know what sort of sheltered life they're living, but
yeah,
Lord knows.
The Death album is the more, not conventional, but certainly a more
less
traditional Melvin-sounding record.
In quotation
now, my
marks.
Take on this record is that if somebody were to dive into Melvin's and say, where did we start? This isn't a bad place to start, because it seems to me like it touches a lot of the bases that you guys are great at. You get the heaviness. You get a little bit of accessibility, sort of like a little bit of a pop thing, but it's kind of in a weird way. And then you get some weirdness. So it's a little bit of what Melvins does best. Dale, what do you,
The whole record seems really dark to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know if that was intentional or not, or maybe we just came in the studio in a mood and it translated onto the recording. I don't really know. But yeah, they're... songs are dark and moody, most of them, except for Steve's happy pop song that he has on there.
You don't understand me. You don't like my candy. You want a handy dandy. Don't you even know that's not how it goes? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with you? What's wrong with me is what's wrong with you. Oh.
Is that why you were recruited, Steve, to bring in the little touch of glorious power pop?
Yeah, I think the focus groups asked for it.
There's probably research dating back to your short-lived and rather infamous tenure with Atlantic Records that said that. Right, Melvins? I mean, if only there was some hooks.
Yeah, the only problem is that we spent a lot of money on those focus groups, and that's all we got was that one song.
And over 34
man,
years, that
oh
doesn't
man.
Go. Does that seem surreal to you right now? 1993 to 1997, you guys are label mates with Rush.
And Zeppelin.
And Zeppelin. You know, the label that brought us Zeppelin and the Stones
Aretha
and Rush.
Aretha Franklin.
Ahmet Erdogan. Yeah. You know, you wonder, did Ahmet ever listen to the Melvins records that came out on Atlantic?
We know he didn't.
We didn't. No, we were on our third record at Atlantic, and we were up in the Los Angeles offices for a meeting. And Ahmet was there, and he was walking in the hallways, and there's the people that work there. It's like, oh, would you like to meet him? I'm like, sure. And he comes in, he's like, great, man. I really can't wait to hear your cat's record.
We're on our third one.
We didn't tell him we were on our
third
one.
There's been three.
I've heard of you guys.
You know, I have to say that around the time of that period that we're talking about, I interviewed a bunch of those bands, as did Jim, from that Seattle scene. You know, Mudhoney and Nirvana and Soundgarden and everyone. You never even had to bring up your name, the Melvins, because they would bring it up for you guys. It was just like it seemed to me like you were more of the outsider band. You were in the state of Washington, but you weren't really a Seattle band. You weren't really part of that scene ever. But you were a touchstone band for all of those bands.
Generally, when I hear it, people say that, the first thing I think is, don't blame me. You know, the best thing that happened to us was moving away from Seattle, moving away from Washington State. We did that around 86, 87.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got out of there is when things started taking off for us a lot more. You know, certainly not while we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. And like, we never had people up there wanting to do albums with us or, you know, wanting to do anything really. Nothing. We got out of there as soon as we did and went to the Bay Area. Things happened really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it had nothing to do with Seattle.
Yeah.
At all, because none of that was happening at that point.
I was out there spending a lot of time with Chris and Kurt of Nirvana when In Utero was about to come out. Their heads were so messed up from what had happened to Nevermind, you know, and I said, well, what did you guys think you would accomplish? And both of them separately said, you know, we were really happy just hauling amps for the Melvins. We loved to be – you're laughing, Dale, right? But, I mean, they were sincere. Number one, they saw you guys as a band with integrity. That you were doing what you wanted to do and creating in the way you wanted to create. And they were wondering at that point in time whether they'd be able to. You know, and it's ludicrous to say. I mean, they probably sold more copies of In Utero in the first hour than everything you've done in 34 years, right?
Probably.
But they saw you as a model that we'd like to do what the Melvins have done.
Yeah, that changed pretty quickly.
Yeah. In Utero was late in the
that
game.
That didn't last long. They surrounded themselves with people that I thought were of low degree. That's a good way to put it.
Industry.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Some of that, but who had little or no time for us. So I didn't have any time for them either. So in order for me to hang around with them more meant that I would have to deal with those people more. And that didn't sound attractive to me at all. You know? Those guys knew exactly what they were doing.
Yeah.
They knew exactly what they wanted. You know, they did not even hesitate to move in a direction that would cause them to sell as many records as possible. So, which isn't bad. I fault no one for being successful.
Yeah.
But then
Dale, is that their cop out? We're gonna throw the name Melvins around because that retains some authenticity.
Might have made him look cool.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
but no, those guys totally knew what they were doing. Even before they got signed, they were writing songs that were more pop oriented. I remember them playing some stuff for me. Maybe it was like About a Girl or something like that. I'm like, you guys been listening to Smithereens? And they kind of went, how did you know?
Yeah.
I can tell.
How did you know?
That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to have a band that was like the Melvins with Beatles influence.
Mm-hmm. You were in Nirvana for a while.
Sort of.
So what was that situation like? How did that happen?
Well, they needed somebody to play drums. You know, the town that we came from didn't have a lot of musicians. And, I mean, I'd been friends with those guys. And already had recorded stuff with Kurt doing his songs on a four-track demo at his aunt's house. I've been looking for Dave, no. Always hearing the same old sticky bottom with a bug. I can make it through things you wouldn't think it ever could. From doing those demos is actually how he formed the band. That's how he ended up getting Chris Novoselic to play with them. We did this demo and Chris heard it and he's like, oh, that's kind of cool. We should start something. So, yeah, I rehearsed their songs and we went and recorded their official demo. And that's the one that basically got them signed.
You ever wonder, Dale, if you'd stuck around with that ride instead of the
Melvins? Where I'd be now, I guess I'd be in the Foo Fighters, wouldn't I? Not playing drums,
probably,
which is a bad idea.
Probably not for long, though, yeah. Probably not for long. Yeah. Buzz, I think one of the reasons the band sort of gravitated to you and sort of saw that you were doing something different than everybody else. That's one thing they would keep citing is that, you know, the Melvins were coming out of this punk underground scene, but they didn't sound like any of the other bands out there. Was that sort of an intentional... Like, they're doing X, I'm definitely doing Y. I don't want to be like these guys.
Yeah, that would be it, you know. I'm not a joiner-inner.
Mm-hmm.
Not by a long shot.
Yeah.
But I'm also not perverse in that I'm going to just intentionally be, you know, the curmudgeon who does the opposite of everybody else. I mean, it's not hard to be massively different than what is popular in whatever scene it is. I had a lot of influences and a lot of weird things I wanted to do. And, you know, without any idea that anyone was ever going to care about it at all, you know. But I never beavered away trying to be unsuccessful, but I also didn't, you know. What will people like? I have no idea what people will like.
Mm-hmm.
No one does. No clue.
Right.
If they did, then everything would sell, you know. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than a band that tries to have that happen. We're going to go for the big amount of money and then have it not work.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they're left with nothing.
Right.
And then they will blame everyone around them except for themselves for why exactly it's not working, which is unfortunate because no one can force you to do anything ever. And I never had that experience even on Atlantic with them trying to tell me what to do. I never had that. But if we'd went to them and said, what should we do? Mm-hmm. They'd have told us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They would have been glad to tell you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But they never did.
Never.
Yeah.
I never. It was not my experience.
Mm-hmm. It just seems like such a wonderfully naive moment in retrospect now where the record companies knew the kids wanted something and we don't know what it is. So we'll just sign bands like the Melvins and the Butthole Surfers and let them do whatever they want.
Yeah. Well, they probably always did that. Probably.
You think so?
Do you really think that in the 50s that there was someone at a record company that said, took a look at Little Richard and said, that's what people are going to want to buy?
Hey, look, baby, put the janks on me. I got the heebie-jeebies and can't get well. I got the heebie-jeebies and the jewel got the tail lip. Hey, mama, baby, then no, no, well, I'm going to ring your door till I break your bell. You got to jump back.
I think that those labels are, they don't, I think he's right when he says they don't know either.
They don't
no
know
one
either.
Knows, you know? Especially when you're talking about these self-contained bands. In the 90s era, I think they were just like, who knew Nirvana was going to happen?
Nobody.
Yeah, nobody.
I had no idea, so therefore I know nothing.
Right.
So I'm going to sign Mudhoney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And let's hope for the best.
But they basically took Nirvana, though, and plugged it into the same circuits that they were selling hair metal in the 80s.
Right.
Same Not machine. Any different.
Right. Same machine.
And then if you look at the way they operated, it's... the same kind of drugs, the same kind of managers, the same kind of tours, the same kind of divorces that any other big, giant rock band has ever been through. So what is the difference?
You get put in the machine and it turns you into that.
It doesn't have to, but that's what happens.
Yeah,
you know?
I guess the exceptions are we can count probably on one hand.
And then they can say, we're anti-corporate rock. Well, it's like you are corporate rock.
Yeah, right. You can't deny that, right?
But they're self-deprecating about it.
Yeah, clearly.
Ironic.
I'm not sure why they felt guilty about that at all, you know?
No, that's what they wanted.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. I mean, you know, back to when I was playing with them, you know, they had a drummer and then kicked him out of the band after they put out their first record, then immediately got offered a tour with Sonic Youth. I went on that tour, and when we were in L.A., we did all these A&R meetings and manager meetings and stuff like that, you know, and everybody was a slime ball.
Hmm. Yeah.
Everybody. But they, that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to get off Sub Pop and sign to a big label.
And make money.
I told them not to sign with Sub Pop.
Uh-huh.
Don't do it.
Really?
Don't trust Sub Pop? It's too big?
No, just don't do it. I don't think you should do that. Don't get involved with them. And they have never got that millstone from around their necks this entire time. Never. And what good did it do them?
Hmm. What didn't you like about Sub Pop from the outside in? What were you skeptical about?
I personally didn't think they knew much about music. Mm. I thought they were kind of dummies, you know, and that they were bootlickers in a lot of ways. And kissing ass in ways that I thought was unattractive.
No. Buzz, I wish you could really express your true feelings sometimes. Yeah. You know, you just need to get that out.
We'll have more with the Melvins after a short break. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Codd with Jim DeRogatis. We are here with the Melvins, legendary band, Buzz Osborne, Dale Crover, Stephen McDonald. Dale, if people know nothing about the Melvins, they may know one or two things. They may know those albums, Houdini and Stoner Witch, that got a little bit bigger push anyway, or ostensibly. Reflecting back, do you feel good about those records? Do they represent you well?
Yeah, I think so. You know, especially the Stoner Witch one, I think is really good. It's got
that is a good
well-rounded.
Record. Yeah.
And I really thought Stag was going to do well. You know, that was when we made that record, I thought, oh, this is it. This is the best record we've done. This is our Sgt. Pepper's. But I was the only one who felt that way.
Fun record to do.
Yeah.
But I couldn't believe they wanted to do three albums. We honestly thought after Houdini it would be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would just move on, do, you know, just some weird little inroad. Mm. But most bands think that if the major label thing doesn't work, then they're finished. And I just never had this idea that that would happen because I'd never thought it would work. So.
Yeah, we always had a backup plan.
Always. Mm-hmm. And just never thought that millions of people were ever going to buy our records. So well, it's like, you guys want to do this? Okay, we'll do it.
You know,
it's not the end of me. You know?
I also think, as much as I love some of these records, that the Melvins, like free jazz, are something that must be experienced live or are better appreciated live.
It doesn't hurt.
Being in a small room with the Melvins is a physical experience. You're going to come out with your innards shook up.
Depending on the PA.
Yeah. house of murder. She's sick of me. And as I'm leaving.
But you guys still seem to take great joy in that live performance.
Oh, yeah.
Or is
that
an
illusion?
It's a big
part of what we do. Yeah. When we got Steven in the band, we were like, we already are fans of what you do. You just do what you do. Just do whatever it is you do. And, you know, that's what we want. So there's no set in stone way of doing anything. And a lot of times when we go back and learn older songs with Steven or with whoever, we don't listen to the old songs. We just get it as close as we can without listening to it. And we a lot of times come up with something I think is better than what was there. I don't want to hear it. You know?
You want to play what it is now, today.
Yeah, even if it's different.
Yeah. What about that word sludge? If we had a database of all the reviews of Melvin's records, 25, 26 of them, I think that's the word that would come up more than any other.
That's just bad journalism, as far as I'm concerned.
I think it's late. Yeah, I don't hear it.
Yeah. I hear some of that, but we have a multitude of sins.
Sludge does not hit you upside the head like a cinder block the way you guys do.
Well, people would describe us in that way who have actually never heard our records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that might just be one element of the music anyway. Sludgy. They're sludgy and slow. Well, you've heard one song.
Right. Yeah. Right. Or part of one song.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just
you almost made it through one song before you turned it off.
Yeah.
It's a compliment these days for the fact that there is no one word that can be hung. I mean, so many bands can really be dismissed with one word.
Yeah, bad.
Yeah, good. Well, that too. Even, you know, Stephen, even if we wanted to call Red Cross power pop, right? I mean, there's a word that means
nothing.
Well,
that's nothing two words.
Anymore. That's two words, right. But so one word or a hyphenated word. But people remain, after 34 years, struggling to describe what the Melvins do.
Yeah, that's their job, you know?
So I think that's an accomplishment.
Yeah, I mean, we've had that happen forever. Yeah. This is the one thing they do. Yeah, really? What would that be? You know.
Well, that's why, and that's also typecasting that the record labels and the corporations would love. It would be easier to market you if you were one thing, but you've never sort of been one thing. And I think that speaks to what you were talking about earlier, is that you're just making stuff that makes you happy as opposed to worrying about what anybody else thinks about it.
I figured eventually people would catch up with it because nothing can last forever.
Mm-hmm. Certainly the record label were scratching their heads with Stag, wondering what it was.
Dodi dodi do.
Is this metal? Is this pop? What do we do with this?
Mm-hmm.
Was their question.
Right.
Don't do anything with it.
Well, you're supposed to figure that one out.
You guys have been together for almost 35 years now.
Yeah, a long time.
Why, Dale? Why?
Why?
What explains that?
We don't know nothing else to do. Yeah, I don't know. I've always liked doing this. I've always believed in the music heavily, and it beats working at a pizza place.
Yeah, and you kind of quit when you've lost interest in it, or no one cares.
And that hasn't
really the only
so
reason
far.
To quit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, I read this thing with Bob Gibson, pitcher for the Cardinals.
Yeah.
And he said he knew it was time for him to quit playing baseball when he was on the mound with 40,000 people there thinking about what he was going to do when he got home.
That's unusually honest. But some of those guys don't quit, too, until their body gives out. I mean,
sometimes they have no choice.
Every time I see you play, I wonder, like, how is he do that?
Yeah.
It's all smoke and mirrors.
Performance-enhancing drugs.
I can also just add that, you know, from the outsider's perspective, that these guys have a very functional partnership, and it's rare in rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Most musicians get hung up with personalities and fear and whatever it is.
We don't argue, really.
They don't have the same kind of limitations.
Nah. Learn to let
same,
it wash
Same
off.
Goal is always in mind, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, whenever we would have personal issues in the band, it was always not between me and him.
Right.
Oh, you were ganging up with the other guy in the band. Yeah. Right?
That's
okay.
What the third player's for, Steven. Yeah.
It was always some pain in the ass from some third party.
Yeah.
You know, you guys play how many gigs a year? I mean, dozens, if not in the triple digits, right?
Yeah.
Somewhere. And
triple digit last year.
Can you get that energy every time you walk on stage? Because I keep hearing musicians talking about that's the thing that wears you down, that grind. When you're not staying in 4-star hotels, you know, like some bands.
The thing that wears you down is all the partying you do afterwards.
Yeah, totally.
you see these people that they canceled their tour because of exhaustion.
Yeah. You know what that means.
It is exhausting staying up for 3 days on coke. Yeah. And
if I was up that long and drinking that much whiskey, I'd be exhausted too.
Come from a certain era that has been documented now countless times, books, movies. Montage of Heck, the Kurt Cobain documentary, is probably the most recent big documentary-style movie that came out about that era.
It's hogwash, 100%.
Montage of Kurt Cobain's trash is what it should have been called.
Where's the...
There was something vulture-like about it. There really was.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
It's just not true. If any of that stuff was true, we'd have known it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that somebody, you're dead today, and somebody digs through your personal belongings, things that you maybe never intended on anyone seeing, and then you're going to take that as truth?
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's just crazy.
So that's what I'm getting at, the mythologizing of what happened.
Yeah. And they knew it wasn't true.
Yeah.
And they still did it anyway because they said it's a better story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bullshit's always a better story.
Though with the animation, they did nail what Aberdeen looked like perfectly.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really weird. Just like, oh my God, that's what, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
It's hogwash.
Reading any of that Nirvana stuff or anything about, you know, Seattle music scene or stuff that happened or stuff that happened with us even, it's like makes me think when it's not true, and I know the truth, that any rock book I've ever read is probably not true at all.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, take it
true Adventures of the Rolling Stones.
It's not true. It's not true. And no one takes more liberties with the truth than a Novoselic. Nobody takes more liberties. No, nobody. No. You will get a highly a filtered version of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Even down to that didn't happen when you were there and it happened.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You guys should write your memoir.
I'm working on it.
The authorized
I'm working
story.
On it. Nobody will like it or believe it either.
I think there'd be some truth telling going on. That would be cool.
Well, there's a good line in the movie Lost Highway where the main character says, I don't like video cameras because I prefer to remember things my own way.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's much better. We've gotten to the point now where me and Dale can't remember who did what. Did you say
I
that?
I thought you said that.
Did I say that?
No, you said that. Not with somebody else entirely.
We have been talking with the Melvins on Sound Opinions. Thank you to Buzz Osborne, Dale Crover, Stephen McDonald for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us. Very
beautiful.
Nice.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think of the Melvins? Or what's your take on the mythology surrounding the 90s Seattle rock scene? Let us know on our hotline, 888-859-1800, or find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. What do we have on the show next week, Greg?
Next week, to start the school year off right, we're going to play our favorite back-to-school songs.
It's time of year I hate, Greg. I have to go back to school, too. Our intern, Isabella Martin, is going back to the University of Chicago. She was part of the team to produce Sound Opinions this week. It also includes Brendan Banaszak, Evan Chung, Alex Claiborne, and Ayanna Contreras.
Operator, can you help me? Help me if you please. Give me the right area code and the number that I need.
My on Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hello, my name is Steve. I'm from Tampa, Florida. I just finished listening to the podcast for the Great One Man Band, and I must say, One of my favorite one-man bands is That One Guy and His Magic Pipe. He's a great artist. He creates very original, entertaining music, and he's definitely worth a listen to or a visit if you can catch him in a live show. All right, thank you. Bye.
Knowing the nose on your face.
Hey guys, this is David from Raleigh, North Carolina. On the one-man band show today, I have an addition for you. How about Ark of a Diver by Steve Winwood? She bathes me in sweetness, I gotta reveal. For sharing dreams, I need my woman. Played all the instruments and sang on that, and it is a top album. Beautiful, poetic, maybe many people remember it when they found their first love or jumped into their first love. So I recommend touching on that one. Have a good day, guys. Enjoy the show.
She rolled in from the west in a summer sundress, hotter than the heat in July. With her wind-blown hair, it just wasn't fair the way she was blowing my mind.
Hey, this is Matt. I'm calling from Nashville. I'm listening to your one-man band section on the radio here as I'm headed home from a gig here. Wanted to give a shout-out to Hunter Hayes if you haven't done that. He's a Nashville country guy, and you know how Nashville country is. It's usually just a bunch of studio musicians and one guy singing the songs that he didn't have anything to do with. But Hunter Hayes is the exception. He played on everything on his record. He really is a talented guy. I've got to play with him a couple times, and he's something else. So if you haven't given anything to Hunter Hayes, you should add him to your list. Thanks so much. I got a feeling by the time the night finds the morning, I'm gonna wish I had a storm morning.
Hello, my name is Clay Goodpasture. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois, and I was just listening to Sound Opinions and heard that you trashed Randy Newman. Ah! Why would you do that? It's NPR! There's a jungle out there. Disorder and confusion everywhere. No one seems to care. Well, I do. Hey, who's in charge here? Hi, my name is Donnie, and I'm calling from Chicago. I wanted to comment on your recent review of the Randy Newman album, and I think it's a fair thing to say that if you go over to someone's house and you hear that album playing, you are about to be murdered, because you would have to be an absolute lunatic to sit and listen to music like that for any extended period of time. Greg, I normally am with you 100%. Not on this one, my man. That music is played in vans with no windows. But I love your show. Thanks for doing what you guys do.
Violence and danger everywhere.
Hello, this is Wayne. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina. I wanted to thank you very much for recognizing Grace Slick. She is a huge influence in the psychedelic scene of San Francisco back in the day in the late 60s, and that is a huge influence on music generally. My favorite songs are on After Bathing at Baxter's. Her voice is just searing, particularly like on Wild Time. Anyway, enjoy the show as usual and keep up the good work. Bye.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.